All right. Good morning. Can everybody hear me all right? I think you can. All right. And so as Aaron said, I'm Ron Lindo Jr. I always have to clarify that because my dad wants me to make sure I tell everybody I'm Ron Lindo Jr. And we've been living here in Marshall, Texas for almost a year. In about a month, it'll have been a year that we moved here, my wife and me, Maya, and our four kids. And we joined Moberly probably about 2 months after moving here to Marshall. And so we've appreciated being members here, and we enjoy the fellowship. Today, one of the things I want to do is walk through Isaiah 49. That's the main passage that I'm going to go through. But before I do that, I guess I'll start off with just kind of acknowledging sort of three goals or three things that I want to try to communicate to everyone today. The first one is I just want to overview kind of what's happening in Revelation chapter 7 and 6, because as a church, in case this is your first time here at the Moberly campus or the Marshall campus of Moberly, the church as a whole has been walking through the book of Revelation. And with me having my Old Testament expertise, pretty much every chapter, because, you know, there's about 500 or so allusions to the Old Testament in the book of Revelation, I'm going, oh, this is, you know, cited from here, so on and so forth, making notes. And so Isaiah 49 is one that's been interesting to me as we've kind of focused on Revelation 7, but I think you need to have some context for what's going on, so I'll do that first. Then I want to try to do the best I can to explain why John would have cited from Isaiah compared to any other passage he could have cited from to get to the same idea. Why does Isaiah 49 help him kind of make his point that he's trying to make here in Revelation chapter 7? And then from there, because it's Memorial Day weekend, I want to connect this to Memorial Day the best I can. That's part of why I titled this Winning the War, because I think we all understand that as in the Christian life, we're doing sort of spiritual warfare and whatnot, but I think that connects to what I would call the heart of the martyr when it comes to the Christian life, and so I'll make that sort of connection there at the end. And so first, let me just overview once again what's happening in Revelation 6 and Revelation 7. And so if you want to open there, you can, because I'll read a few verses to sort of give you some context, but then we'll jump, like I said, into Isaiah 49. And so as Pastor Jeffrey has done a good job of explaining, chapter 7 is somewhat of a respite or an interlude compared to all of the sort of tragic things that have happened so far in the book of Revelation, especially in chapter 6, where you have this judgment that God is bringing upon everyone. He brings it upon the great and the small, and it's contextualized this way. It says that the kings, the great ones, the generals, the rich, the powerful, some translations are going to say slaves after this, but they were probably people who worked in the royal court, so they were like bond servants who actually worked in the higher echelon of the ancient world, and the free. They all are mentioned in chapter 6, and they're people who, in a sense, probably had some sort of autonomy, some sort of control over their lives to a greater extent than maybe the average person, because they're in the upper echelon of the ancient world. And these people are all hiding from God. And one way you can think about this and to contrast it with what's going on there is these are people, once again, who would have had some sort of control, some sort of autonomy. And because they have this sort of self-autonomy, they've not submitted themselves to God. So therefore, they want to hide from him when they see his presence, when he's around them. In contrast to that, you have the people in chapter 7 who are just mentioned as this great multitude who are all worshiping God. And they're described as martyrs, which we'll come back to, people who pretty much have given their lives over to God, and they kind of see the same sort of reality of God, but instead of wanting to run from that, they want to kind of lay themselves at the feet of God, lay themselves at God's mercy. And so I've got the comparison here in Revelation 6:16 and 7:15, which should show up here for you on the screen. Notice there's a few things that are common about what they're both saying. So in Revelation 16, these are all the people, once again, I mentioned before, the kings, the great ones, the generals, the rich, the powerful. They all say to the mountains and the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of the one seated on the throne, from the wrath of the Lamb. In contrast to that, you get the same phrasing in Revelation 7:15, where it says, for this reason they are before the throne of God, which you could parallel to being before his face. That's probably the general sort of connection there. And they serve him day and night in his temple, and the one sitting on the throne will shelter them. So notice that they have the same reality. They both understand that God has ultimate authority, that God's throne is sort of above everything else, and that they need to submit to this in some way, shape, or form. But once again, the people in Revelation chapter 6 pretty much want to run from that because they don't want to submit to this reality. They want to almost ignore this reality compared to the people in Revelation 7 understand this reality and submit themselves to that. And so once again, these are the people in Revelation 7 who have given their autonomy away in the heart of the martyr. And this contrast continues, and I think this is important, especially for understanding why John would have cited from Isaiah 49 instead of any other sort of passage that he could have cited from, where it's not just this phrasing of those who are the Lamb being seated on the throne and them acknowledging God's authority. There's also some implications of what it means for God to be on his throne. And these are contrasted once again in Revelation 6 and 7, and this should be on the next one coming up here. And I'll read the verses for you to once again help you have some context for what's happening here. So in Revelation 6, it starts in verse 12. It says, when he opened the sixth seal, I looked and behold, there was a great earthquake and the sun became black as sackcloth. The full moon became like blood and the stars of the sky fell to the earth as the fig tree sheds its winter fruit when shaken by a gale or a strong wind is another way you could have translated that. In contrast to that, you get in Revelation chapter 7, verses 16 and 17, they shall hunger no more, neither thirst anymore. The sun will not strike them, nor any scorching heat. For the Lamb in the midst of the throne will be their shepherd. He will guide them to springs of living water, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. And the contrast that's happening here is, I would say, it's related to agricultural wealth or prosperity. So those who, once again, have rejected God, the implications of that is they can't really continue their path. They can't continue the sort of commerce or economic stability that you might want in the world. They have earthquakes, once again. The sun becomes black and the moon is red. The stars fall to the earth, which should make you think about Genesis chapter 1, where God put the stars in the sky for seasons, for crops to grow, for all of the things that we need in life in order to prosper as people. In contrast to that, if those who have submitted themselves to God have everything they need, they're not going to hunger or thirst. The sun is not going to strike them. The heat is going to be fine for them. They're going to be able to live in the heat, I guess, is another way you could say that. And they're going to be guided to springs of living water. They're going to have everything they need to prosper and grow. And ideally, that's the world we all want. We just all, in a sense, disagree over how to get there, which is why we've not yet achieved that. And so you could read these two chapters and sit back and go, the problem here, though, is we don't really experience either of these two extremes all of the time. So, you know, I was just thinking this morning, I can scroll through my Facebook feed and I can see people who are saying, you know, pretty much it's the end of the world, everything's horrible, life is over, whatever the case may be. But it's still not as bad as what's happening in Revelation chapter 6, right? It's just not gotten that bad yet. And I can also scroll through my Facebook feed and read all these people who are talking about graduation, all these good things, revivals that are happening all over the world. That sounds, once again, very similar to Revelation chapter 7, but it's still not as good as that. And the reality is we live somewhere in the middle, and this is on the next slide here. We live in what's called this present age, and you really could call it the present evil age, because the reality is we tend to go more towards resistance to God than blessing from God. That's just the inclination of our hearts. And so even though we should all want to live in the blessings of God, ultimately we don't achieve that for a variety of reasons. And so one verse I think that helps us at least begin to ponder this and gives us some context before we get into Isaiah 49 is in the book of James. This is in James chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. And it says this, what is the source of wars and fighting among you? Don't they come from the cravings that are at war within you? You desire and you do not have. You murder and covet and cannot obtain. You fight and war. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and don't receive because you ask with wrong motives, so you may spend it on your evil desires. And I would argue that's, once again, one of the reasons we can label this present world as the present evil age is, even though the world is not as bad as it could be, even though it's not as good as it can be, our own desires, even for those of us who sometimes want the best intentions and are trying to sort out exactly how we need to live for God day to day, even we end up every now and then giving in to our evil desires and doing something that harms someone else, so therefore it leans us towards this evil world. And so part of what I want to ponder here is, so what is the strategy? What is the goal of the Christian life to help us get closer and closer to what we see in Revelation chapter 7? Because pretty much we all agree, I think, if I asked, you know, people, non-Christians or just anyone, do you want to end world hunger? Do you want to end sunburns and droughts? That's described there in Revelation 7. And do you want to make sure the entire world has access to clean water? Almost everyone would agree, yes, that's what we want. That's the goal. That's where we're trying to get. But once again, we all disagree on how to get there. And for the Christian, we get there through the model of Christ. We get there through following his example. And so I want to help us sort of ponder how Isaiah 49 helps us think that through. And so just to, once again, clarify this, I know I've talked about this already. So on the next slide here is, you get this citation once again at the end of Revelation 7, where he cites from Isaiah 49. And I've highlighted for you here in the yellow. There's some different wording here because it's, you know, one is in Hebrew, one is in Greek, but it's basically the same thing there at the beginning. Notice that John does add some sections to his citation, though. He adds this statement here, for the Lamb who's at the center of the throne will shepherd them. It's because he wants to clarify who is the one that's being mentioned in Isaiah 49. So he wants to clarify that. And then he adds a citation from Isaiah 25:8, that God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. And I'm not going to get into why he cites from Isaiah 25. I'll be in the back afterwards if you want to ask me questions. I'll help to clarify that. The short thing I'll say is, really what the New Testament authors tend to do is they tend to look at a variety of verses in the Old Testament and pull those all together to kind of get to their point. But I don't think they ever forget the original context from what they're citing from. So I don't think John just kind of forgot that, oh, this is really in chapter 25, not in 49, even though they didn't have chapters at the time. I think he knows where that is in the book of Isaiah, but he thinks it helps prove his point as well. And so he kind of puts all of this together. And we're just going to focus on, once again, one part of this from Isaiah 49. And so before we do this, though, I think it's worth keeping in mind this verse from Hebrews, chapter 4, verse 15, which says this, we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in every way as we are, yet without sin. And one of the reasons why I want us to keep that verse in mind is because when we read through Isaiah 49, I want to point out some things to you that would not make you think that this is about Jesus. There's a section, which I guess I'll just highlight really quickly, but we'll walk through it here in a second, where it talks about how he failed, how he didn't accomplish the mission of God, at least not the way he expected this mission to be accomplished. And it sounds very human. It doesn't really sound like the Messiah, per se. And I wanted to try to clarify as best I can that there was some ambiguity as to exactly what that verse was talking about. So when Isaiah 49 was originally written, there was all kinds of conversation. Is this about the Messiah? Is this about people? Is this about the nation of Israel? Is this about some future Israel that's yet to come? There's all kinds of conversations that people were happening until Christ appeared and Christians said, okay, yeah, this is talking about the Messiah. And I think understanding that tension is also helpful to understanding what's really going on in that passage. And so I'm going to try to walk us through that really quickly. So if you're not there already, you can go ahead and open up to Isaiah 49. And we're going to work really slowly through verses 1 through 5 specifically, and then I'll kind of lead us up into the citation from Revelation 7 that's there in Isaiah 49:10. So I'll give you a minute to turn there if you're not there now. And I also think while you're turning there that, you know, I didn't want to put every single verse up here for you to read, because even if you don't have it in front of you, I tend to bring my phone to church, you know, so I normally look it up that way. But even if you don't have it in front of you, I think it's worth even just listening to this passage, because I think you'll be able to get the effect that the passage is trying to give, even if you just hear it orally read to you. So I'll walk us through each verse slowly and kind of comment as we go along. So verse 1 says this: "Coast and islands, listen to me. Distant peoples, pay attention. The Lord called me before I was born. He named me while I was in my mother's womb." And so you're supposed to read this verse and go, okay, the whole world needs to pay attention to this. From the coast and islands, the distant peoples, that's away from this, the location of Israel, to say pretty much everyone in the world needs to pay attention to this. But then this gets kind of softened as you kind of keep reading on, because it just says, from there, the Lord called me and he named me while I was in my mother's womb. And there's really nothing unique about this. This would have been true for pretty much everyone who's a believer, and I can cite some examples for you that I have here, like Samson in Judges 6:7, who's not the ideal example of who it is to be a believer and to follow God. He says this, that I'm a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. Him emphasizing this idea that I've been called, I've got a purpose, I've got a goal. The same sort of language that we find here in Isaiah 49:1. And then you get another one even in the book of Job, where Job says something very similar in Job 1:21. "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will leave this life. The Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And Job being obviously a much better example, so I wanted to give, you know, those two contrasts. So once again, what this verse is saying about this individual so far is not really unique, but somehow this birth that's happening, the whole world is supposed to pay attention to. And so we got to continue to sort of ponder what's going on here. And in verses 2 and 3, we kind of get what's more unique about this individual that's different from everyone else. So in verse 2 here, it says, "And he," talking about God, "made my words like a sharp sword." And that should make you think about Revelation chapter 1, verse 16. We've already had that description of Jesus throughout the book of Revelation. So he says, "He made my words like a sharp sword, and he hid me in the shadow of his hand. He gave me like a sharpened arrow. He hid me in his quiver. He said to me, 'You are my servant Israel, in whom I will be glorified.'" And so notice a few things here. There's a lot of war language mentioned here, right? You have the sword. He's in the shadow of God's hand. And so you could think about, normally in the Old Testament, when it's talking about God's hand, it's talking about something miraculous that God's going to do. So like when he went to war for the Israelites, when he did the 10 plagues in Egypt. So you've got this sort of warlike language here. He's a sharpened arrow that's in God's quiver. But notice everything is indirect. It's not direct warfare. It's indirect warfare that's described here. So instead of saying he has a sword in his hand, which is what you'd expect, the sword is coming from his mouth. It's his words that are going to do war here. Instead of saying he is God's hand, which is what you would expect, he's in the shadow of God's hand. So it's like he's kind of under God's hand instead of actually being God's hand. Instead of being a sharpened arrow that's ready in the bow, ready to be shot and to actually harm someone, he's hidden in the quiver. So it's like, okay, whatever warfare this person is going to be involved in, it's going to be indirect. It's not going to be as direct as you might assume it's going to be. And then in verse 3, this is almost like his mantra. It's almost like he wakes up every morning and says this: "You are my servant Israel, in whom I will be glorified. You are my servant Israel, in whom I will be glorified." That's probably the way we need to understand this, that he wakes up every morning and it's like, okay, this is my purpose. This is what I've got going on. And so once again, just to help contextualize this before we get to the sort of contrast that's about to come up here, is somehow, some way, this birth that's about to happen is more important than any other birth, even though it seems very similar. Somehow, some way, this person is going to be engaged in warfare, but it's going to be a different sort of warfare than the normal sort of warfare that we would expect. And he's got this, once again, mantra that labels himself as Israel, which is a lofty task because the whole nation of Israel couldn't do the job of Israel. So how can this one individual person finally accomplish the goal that God has had for Israel all the way from the beginning? So then you get in verse 4, almost this sort of awkward contrast to everything we've read so far. And maybe another way for me to say this is, it was very optimistic a minute ago, and now it's about to turn and not be so much in verse 4, at least the beginning of it. It says this: "But I myself said, I have labored in vain. I have spent my strength for nothing in futility. Yet my vindication is with the Lord, and my reward is with my God. And so part of you is supposed to read this and go, what's going on here? We were so optimistic. You've got this mantra. You know that you're Israel. You know what your purpose is. This is a unique birth. How did you fail? And you almost want the author here, Isaiah, to explain this to us. Like, what happened? What did he do wrong? He had everything he needed to do in order to accomplish the mission of God, but somehow he didn't accomplish the mission of God. Instead, he's just okay with saying, my vindication is with the Lord, my reward is with God, as if saying, like, well, it'll happen eventually, but it's not happened now in the way that maybe you would expect. And so once again, you'd want to keep reading here, and you get to verse 5, and you'd expect verse 5 to sort of explain what's happening. But once again, it doesn't. It just kind of goes back to verse 1 and just summarizes that God's original goal is still his goal. So if you read verse 5 there, it says, and now, says the Lord, who formed me from the womb to be his servant, which is once again the same thing we just read in verse 1 here of Isaiah 49, to bring Jacob back to him so that Israel might be gathered to him. So that's the same thing as his mantra, I'm Israel in whom you will be glorified. For I'm honored in the sight of the Lord, and my God is my strength. And so once again, this doesn't resolve the conflict or the failure that's happened here. It just reminds us that that was God's original purpose, and this purpose is still going to be accomplished. And so there's a variety of ways that I could have tried to demonstrate this to you, but I felt the best way here was just to kind of show you what's happening in the Hebrew. I tend to normally try to avoid talking about Hebrew when I'm preaching to people who don't all know Hebrew, but hopefully this one will be a good example to show to you here in this slide here. So pretty much what happens here is you have two different words for honor or glorified and two different words for strength that are used here in Hebrew. And it's an exchange of synonyms. So you go from like weaker synonyms to stronger ones. So maybe you can think about it in English as a way of saying like angry and irate or happy and exuberant. You're going from a weaker synonym to a stronger synonym. And so first off, he started off saying in his mantra that I'm going to be glorified, pakar, that God in a sense is going to be glorified in me. But now he's saying he has kavod. He has a stronger sense of honor, a stronger sense of glorification in God, even though he failed. So somehow he failed, and it's a stronger intensification. The same thing with Koach there, where he's talking about he had his strength, his own strength, that he felt like it had kind of accomplished the goals of God. But now he's saying, oh no, the Lord is my strength. The Lord is my oz. I've got a stronger strength now. Once again, even though I failed, somehow I've turned out better off than where I started off from the beginning. And then from there, and I'm just going to summarize these verses for you very, really quickly. From there, in verses 6 through 10, it doesn't just clarify that not only was this individual who's supposed to do the mission of God better off now after his failure, somehow he's better off than he was when he started. This is true for the rest of the world as well. So there in verse 6, it clarifies in Isaiah 49, 6, not only will Israel be redeemed, but the entire world. So it says, I will make you a light for the nations to be my salvation to the ends of the earth. In verse 7, it says, even though the Messiah or the individual that's being mentioned here who I would identify as the Messiah was despised and abhorred, the kings and the princes will bow down to him. And this, to me, is also reminiscent of what's happening in Revelation chapter 6, where you've got these kings and these strong people who have to submit to God's authority. The same sort of thing is, I think, happening here in verse 7. Then you got verse 8, during a time of favor, God will use the servant to restore his people and the land to give them this agricultural wealth that we talked about before in Revelation 7. In verse 9-8, it says, to those who are prisoners, they will be set free. They're going to be called out from being prisoners. And then we get the verse that was cited in Revelation 7 here in verse 9b and 10, or the second part of verse 9 and 10, that they're going to have plenty to eat, and they're going to be led by springs of water. And so, once again, what's happening in this passage in Isaiah 49 is somehow, some way, this individual whose birth is supposed to be greater than any other in the world was going to do some sort of warfare that's unique, that's not the normal way in which you'd fight a war. In fact, if you fought a war this way, you would lose. He ends up losing in verse 4, and then somehow he's better off in the long run, and the rest of the world is better off, even though he lost, instead of him actually winning the war. And so I want to connect this with you for you really quickly in Acts chapter 2, because we get the same sort of structure that happens when Peter tells the story of what Christ did when he appeared in the world. He starts off with just talking about, okay, Jesus was this individual from Nazareth who did all these miracles and wonders, who did all these optimistic things. He did the things that you would expect. He had this sort of great beginning. But then he was delivered up and killed on a cross. He died. He failed, in a sense. He did not accomplish this the way in which you would have expected him to accomplish it. But then he says in verse 24 there that God raised him up, ending the pains of death because it was not possible for him to be held by death. So somehow he's better off, even though he died, than he was in the beginning. So I know, especially those of you who attend church regularly, you would probably not like me saying this was a failure, right? We talk about the cross. We don't ever say, oh, the cross was a failure, this was bad. We say, oh, this is a good thing that Christ died for us. He redeemed us. But I think sometimes we miss the fact that this is not, once again, the way in which you should win a war. So maybe you can think about it this way. If we did a military combat today of any sort, and we sent 13 troops or 100 troops or whatever, and they all died, we wouldn't walk away from that and say, this was great. We're so glad that we had these people die. We'd say, no, this sucks. This is horrible. This is not the way in which it's supposed to happen. And I think that's the same way we're supposed to view the cross, that this is, from a worldly standpoint, a failure. Christ did not accomplish the goals in which he wanted to accomplish, at least not the way in which the world would have expected this to happen. And so from there, I think we can try to draw some implications for why does this matter for us? Not only does this bring about our redemption, obviously, why does it matter for us that we understand that the cross was somewhat of a failure from worldly standards? And so I want to go back to Revelation chapter 7 and focus on a few verses that are kind of hidden into this chapter. Even though this chapter is very optimistic and it's very clear about the future that God is going to bring, this future blessed age that's going to come one day, it does have subtle hints about the sort of failure in which God's people also need to experience, which I'm going to call the heart of the martyr, in order for us to actually do our part in sort of bringing about this sort of kingdom of God one day in the future. So if you look at Revelation chapter 7, verse 9, it says this: "After this I looked, and there was a vast multitude from every nation, tribe, people, and language, and no one could number them, standing before the throne and before the Lamb. They were clothed with robes of white, with palm branches in their hand." And so you might read that verse once again and go, okay, this is great. They're wearing all white. And there's this vast multitude. They're praising God. All things are great. But then, of all the things in this chapter that are mysterious that could have been explained, which we could have hoped for, the elder goes up to John and only explains one part of what's happening in this part of the vision. And so this is in verse 13 here. He goes up to him and says this: "Then one of the elders asked me, 'Who are these people in white robes, and where did they come from? What do you understand about what's happening with them wearing white?' And I, John, said to him, 'Sir, you know.'" Well, he's like, "I don't know. This is confusing to me. So can you clarify this for me?" And then he told me, "These are the ones coming out of the great tribulation. They've washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb." So not only are you supposed to read this and say, washing something in blood doesn't make it white. that's the opposite of what's supposed to happen here. I think there's also a few other sort of implications we can draw from this. The first is, I think there's some tension that's happening here, the same sort of tension we found in Isaiah 49, the same sort of tension we find in our world, the same sort of tension you see here in Revelation 7, where John doesn't seem to know what's happening here. And this tension should lead us to understand that we're not always going to get all the answers that we want in this present age. Sometimes things are going to be explained to us, but sometimes they're not going to be explained to us. And I think that's helpful for us to sort of understand as we live in this age and try to seek out God's will. And second, I think it's supposed to teach us to be humble. I think it's supposed to teach us that we need to be people who are humble, who can understand that sometimes we need to get advice and wisdom about the things of God from those who are closest to God or those who have experienced God much longer. I think that's part of the reason why he's called an elder here versus any other term that could have been used to describe this person, that we need to submit ourselves to those who actually have experienced living through this age in a better way than we have and learn from them each and every day. And then from there, I also think there's this implication of, once again, what it means to take on the heart of the martyr, the heart of someone who's submitted themselves to God, who's given up their autonomy so that God can have autonomy instead. And so I want to conclude here with two quotes that I want us to focus on. The first one is from N.T. Wright here. And to me, this is helpful to understanding what it means when Christ talks about, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me, which we see in, you know, Matthew 16:24 and in a few of the other gospels who say things like that. And so here's the quote from N.T. Wright, which should show up here in a second. He says this. He says, the chief thing that the monster, and by monster he means the enemies of the world, the people who have turned their backs on God, the same sort of powerful people that are described in Revelation chapter 6. The chief thing the monster can do then and now is to kill. That's its ultimate weapon. That's the one thing that they have as their sort of trump card. Jesus believed in a God who could and would raise the dead. And so in a sense, what N.T. Wright is getting at is God's ability to resurrect people from the dead is his means of overthrowing the enemy without actually engaging in direct combat with the enemy, though God is going to do some of that, to be fair, and that's part of what's being described in Revelation 6. But his ultimate victory is going to come from actually giving us access to the resurrection in the same way that he resurrected Christ. And so once again, as I would describe this, I don't think the heart of the martyr is saying, I'm looking forward to death. I don't think any of us should do that. But I think it's saying, I'm willing to put myself in positions that might require this, knowing that there's a God who can resurrect me. If my faith is going to cost me something, I'm never going to lose everything because God has the ultimate trump card. He has the ultimate means of which we can win this war in the long run. And so another quote here that I want us to focus on, though I could have, you know, highlighted sort of several other factors, I think Henry Nguyen, I think, does a good job of highlighting two aspects of the Christian life that I think are important for us to emphasize. The first one is confession. And the second one is forgiveness, and this is what he has to say about those two things. He says, through confession, the dark powers are taken out of their cardinal isolation, brought into the light and made visible to the community. So he's saying confession helps us, once again, defeat the evil powers of the world in a way in which sometimes we forget. Then he says, through forgiveness, they are disarmed and dispelled, and a new integration between body and spirit is made possible. And as I was reading this quote, it made me think about two times that Christ models both of those as well. For confession, remember that as Christ is going to the cross, as he's going to do the ultimate act that's going to help him sort of win the war of the enemies of darkness, he says this. He says, after, you know, in Matthew 26:39, he says, and going a little further, he fell on his face and prayed, saying, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. So that Christ is, in a sense, engaged in confession to bring to light things to model for us in the same way that we should sort of be in confession to bring those, once again, dark powers out of their cardinal isolation. And then similarly, Christ says this while he's on the cross in Luke 23:34, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And once again, I have a trouble forgiving people when they cut me off in traffic, let alone forgiving someone when they're nailing me on a cross. And I think that's the level of forgiveness that the heart of the martyr would actually demonstrate on a day-to-day basis. And so as I conclude here, to me, I think one of the valuable reasons that we should celebrate Memorial Day and all of those who have died in order for us to have our freedom here in America is not that the goals of America are just as pure and valuable as the goals of the Christian life, but that the goal of being someone who's willing to put your life on the line is something that we should all honor, and that's something we all need to model as best we can, and I think that's part of what Christian discipleship is about, is getting closer and closer to the point where you're ready to be sacrificial in the same way that Christ was, knowing that ultimately God has the ultimate trump card, that the resurrection is going to bring us to a place where we can experience and be a part of this future blessed age, and that we have a part to play in that through acts of prayer, confession, forgiveness, so on and so forth, and never neglect those things. And so I'll pray for us, and then afterwards, like I said, I'll be in the back to answer any questions that anyone might have. Lord God, I'm thankful for your word. I'm thankful to be a part of your church. I'm thankful for your sacrifice. And so help us, help me each and every day to grow closer to you, to take on the heart that you had, to know that in the eyes of the world, forgiveness and confession and weakness in any way, shape, or form that is close to the same sort of weakness that you demonstrated on the cross is often laughed at, is often considered invaluable. But those tools, those acts of godliness are valuable tools that you want us to model to the world so that we can slowly by slowly, piece by piece, bring the world closer to this future blessed age that you have in mind for all of us. It's all these things in Jesus' name. Amen.